Hello, and welcome to the Resilient Life podcast. Resilient Life is part of peakprosperity.com. It's where we focus on practical and actionable knowledge for building a better future. I'm your host, Adam Taggart, and today's guest is Rob Wolf. A former research biochemist, Rob worked with Lauren Cordain, creator of the best-selling book, The Paleo Diet. Rob has since authored his own New York Times bestseller, The Paleo Solution, The Original Human Diet, and he now focuses on educating people on how to achieve better health through nutrition and fitness. As many listeners know, my business partner Chris Martinson lost over 30 pounds a few years back following many of the practices Rob advocates. I should also mention that Chris has remained at this new weight ever since. So as we look at the likely trends in store for the future, remaining fit and healthy will take on heightened importance, especially when we look at factors like peak cheap energy, which will require humans to do more by hand. And with a continued escalation in medical costs, healthcare will likely be less affordable and possibly less available in future decades. I've invited Rob on the program to discuss the practical side of staying in good health. What are the specific practices we as individuals and as communities should be adopting in our daily lives? Rob, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Adam, huge honor to be on the show. This is the most excited I've ever been to be on any show, honestly. I absolutely love the work you guys do.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to hear that. And I'll tell you, flattery will get you everywhere here.
Perfect.
Well, why don't we start with, for those that might not be that familiar with the Paleo framework, could you just give a brief overview of the framework as you see it and what you think the average person should understand about it?
Sure. You know, this paleo diet concept, I actually call it a paleo template because it really goes beyond simply food. And we're just kind of taking this evolutionary biology perspective, looking at the way that humans evolved as hunter-gatherers and using that to inform some decisions about food, sleep, exercise, community, and try to bring this all into a kind of a coherent way to make some informed decisions. So, you know, there's all kinds of opinions about, you know, how we should eat, what type of exercise is beneficial for us, you know, whether or not we actually need sound sleep or how much sleep we need. And I think using this kind of evolutionary template provides some really great information in that regard. You know, from an exclusion standpoint, which is kind of the easier way to explain it, a paleo diet, we start with the assumption that some of these Neolithic foods, grains, legumes, and dairy might be problematic because they're what we would call evolutionarily novel foods. The fact that they're newly arrived on the scene, you know, with regards to our genetics, that there might be some problems there. And anything that's new doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, immediately problematic. But if we see problems like obesity, neurodegenerative diseases, increased cancer rates, which we definitely see those things in our populations, our westernized populations, then maybe looking at our dietary factors and some of the factors related to our diet might inform some ways both, you know, for more effective medicine and some basic lifestyle interventions that we can do to improve our health.
All right, great. And you mentioned a couple of new entrants there to the human diet. We've had a pretty active discussion on the site recently about, I guess evils probably is the right word to use it, but the evils of gluten and some of the some of the grain-based diets in terms of irritation, inflammation, you know, obviously raising your glycemic index and storing more food as fat. Help me understand what legumes do and also what the issues can be with dairy too, besides just the
Sure.
regular lactose intolerance.
You know, most people are familiar at this point with this idea of gluten being problematic. You know, there's an autoimmune condition called celiac disease, in which a protein in gluten causes an autoimmune reaction in the gut lining, and that can lead to systemic inflammation. And inflammation is a process that it's kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. We don't want too little. We don't want too much. We want just the right amount. And when we consume gut-irritating foods, and I would also put in gut-irritating pharmaceuticals like acetaminophen and ibuprofen and some other thing, we don't want to overuse those. But when we create an inflammatory response in the gut, then that inflammation can then lead to what we call systemic inflammation or problems throughout the whole body. And I would put wheat specifically or gluten-containing items, wheat, rye, oats, barley, millet, at the very, very far end of this problematic spectrum. I would put other grains like corn and rice, much less problematic, but depending on the individual's makeup, they may respond very negatively to them or not so much. And then grains, I would kind of put in that same kind of, you know, somewhat middle ground category that many people notice, gastric reflux, kind of GI irritation. There's some interesting linkage with legume consumption and autoimmune disease. And then the dairy piece, I put dairy in kind of what I would consider like a B-level food category, and it's unrelated to the lactose intolerance. Folks are usually familiar with lactose intolerance being an issue for many, many folks, but there's actually proteins in dairy which are very, very similar structurally to proteins in gluten. And if somebody is cross-reactive to gluten and they end up with an inflammatory response to gluten, it's very common for them to have a cross-reactivity to at least cow dairy, but then many people find that they can consume some goat or other types of dairy, particularly the raw varieties, raw and fermented, which changes the protein a bit, you know, just from having a different species. And then also the fermentation process tends to make the proteins a little bit more accessible to our digestive tract.
All right. And what exactly, what kind of toll does too much inflammation exert? What type of damage does it do to the human body?
Gosh, you know, that's kind of $1 million or $1 billion question right now. It appears that just about everything that we see from a Western degenerative disease state appears to have an underpinning of systemic inflammation as a root cause. Neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, cardiovascular disease is kind of a slam dunk element in this regard. We really understand that the inflammatory response and the endothelial lining of the vasculature is a key step in the propagation of atherosclerosis and also, you know, potentially having a stroke or a heart attack, various types of cancer, particularly breast, colon, prostate cancers, glioblastomas, astrocyte brain tumors, appear to have a very tight linkage with both elevated insulin levels and systemic inflammatory response. And then getting into autoimmune diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera, a clear linkage with inflammation. And it's still unclear, you know, whether or not the inflammation is the cause or it's the effect of a disease state. But it's pretty clear that when we do things like get our vitamin D levels elevated, sleep better, remove gut-irritating foods, and we can track via blood work, like a reduction in C-reactive protein, which is an indicator of systemic inflammation. If we reduce those markers, those blood markers, then we tend to see an amelioration of the disease states. So it's still unclear whether the inflammation is the cause or you know, exactly what's going on, but it definitely fixing that problem seems to really go a long ways towards helping people.
Okay, and it certainly sounds like that problem is correlated with a whole host of pretty scary diseases that we're aware of that you just listed. What is it about wheat in particular that puts it so far out on the bad spectrum?
Gosh, you know, the type of protein that's in wheat, most grains and pseudograins, if people think about this a little bit, you know, in biology, everything has thorns or horns or teeth or venom or something, you know. I mean, it's really not a, you know, this kind of benign Walt Disney kind of story out in ecology. Like either things are being eaten or they are doing the eating and all critters or plants have some sort of an anti-predation strategy. And part of the anti-predation strategy that grains employ are anti-nutrients which inhibit the digestive process of critters that eat them, and also some things that actually cause direct inflammation to the organisms that eat them. And so wheat in particular has some just very difficult to digest proteins, and there are some proteins which are what we would call immunogenic. They cause an immune response, whether it's the innate immune response which causes kind of systemic inflammation or an autoimmune response in the case of celiac disease. And it's also worth mentioning that the people who are particularly reactive to gluten, which tends to be Northern Europeans, there appears to have been an adaptation somewhere early in the transition from the hunter-gatherer life way to the agricultural life way, when people started living in close proximity both to each other and to animals. We started getting exposed to a very, very high bacterial and viral load. And one of the adaptations that occurred in this this time was that folks who now show the tendency towards celiac disease, these people, interestingly, the one of the genetic adaptations that they have is that they tend to be more robust, more resilient with regards to gut pathogens. They tend to be more immunized against the effects of say, like, foodborne illnesses. But the trade-off with that, there's always trade-offs in biology and ecology and, you know, economics. And one of the trade-offs for the people who have celiac disease is even though they may be more resistant to gut pathogens, they are more highly reactive to gluten proteins. And peanuts are another good example. You know, many people are very familiar with how, you know, immunologically reactive peanuts are. And when you look at the proteins that are in peanuts and these things called lectins, which are part of the peanut makeup, they tend to be, you look at them on an electron micrograph, they're very complex structures, they're kind of pointy and pokey, and they really just irritate the immune system. Whereas if we were to look at the proteins that we find in rice or the ability to break down proteins that we would find in, say, meat or chicken or fish, these things tend to be easier to digest and they just tend to be less immunogenic.
So basically you're mentioning that, during my teenage years, when I pretty much subsisted on peanut butter sandwiches, I was probably doing about the worst thing for my digestive tract that I could have done. Huh?
It was Russian roulette on par with a hooker and cocaine binge. Yeah. Yeah. It was a dangerous activity. Yeah.
Wow. What an analogy. So when people go off wheat diets or remove wheat from their diet more largely try to take gluten out of their diet, we have a lot of reports, and certainly amongst our own site readership, that you know, people tend to lose weight pretty quickly once they've made that slight change. And I say slight meaning, you know, they're just removing something from the diet. I know going off those foods once you're used to eating them in your diet is not necessarily an easy thing to do. But what is it about the body's biochemistry that, results in that weight loss when you're removing gluten from your diet?
You know, there's a couple of different factors there. And I honestly, I don't think we're at a point where we fully understand what the mechanisms are. But we do understand on a base level that if the body is under stress, say like if the gut is irritated, when the body is under a stressful situation, we tend to elevate a hormone called cortisol. When cortisol is elevated, we are just in kind of a fight or flight kind of scenario, and the body really, really likes to hold on to calories during that time. Sleep deprivation, overactivity, actually overtraining can cause this effect, and this is where, you know, some people will do, aerobics classes all day, or they spend hours and hours and hours on the bicycle, but they still have a pretty good jelly roll through the midsection, and so that's a piece of the story. Another piece of the story, there's been some really fascinating research where they look at the gut endobiome, the bacteria that live symbiotically in our guts. And there's been some fascinating research where they will take, say, like a lean variety of mice, an obese variety of mice. They will expose these mice to, they will remove some bacteria from both of the strains of mice, expose them to antibiotics, basically wiping out all the gut flora in both strains. And they'll take the skinny mouses or mice gut bacteria and put it into the fat mice, take the obese mice gut bacteria and put it in the skinny mice, and we end up seeing a switch in the phenotype in the way that these two critters express their genetics. The skinny becomes overweight, the overweight becomes skinny, and there appears to be some issues with certain foods causing a change in gut bacteria. It is another layer to the story, which is I would say maybe the last 5 years we've just had an explosion in this understanding, and honestly, it makes my head spin trying to figure out some of that stuff. There's a really amazing project called the Human Gut Project where these anthropologists are going out and cataloging the intestinal bacterial contents of humans all over the planet. They're in Africa right now studying the Hadza, one of the last remaining hunter-gatherer groups, and kind of looking at how they live and what they're the bacteria on their skin, the bacteria in their mouth, the bacteria in their gut, and what that looks like. So, I think that we could definitely be comfortable saying there's an element of this related to gut bacteria, and there's also an element of this related to systemic inflammation leading to hormonal changes that just kind of prime us for being prone to storing body fat.
Okay, and then by... ceasing eating these foods that cause the inflammation and whatnot, we bring the cortisol levels down, and the body just stores fat at a lower level, and that's why people are dropping weight?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's another thing. Lots of fascinating studies in sleep research where people will change nothing about their food intake, nothing about their activity level, but they simply sleep more or less, and the people who sleep more and are more rested, have lower systemic inflammation, better hormonal profile, they tend to store less body fat at a given caloric intake, whereas the people who are sleep deprived, they will actually gain more body fat at a given food intake. So this stress element becomes really, really important, and we can get this stress vector coming from a variety of areas: overtraining, lack of sleep, cognitive stress, and then also foodborne stress via gut irritation.
Right. Interesting. So we've talked about diet, and related to diet, we've talked about the importance of your gut flora, which is probably something that the average person really doesn't give much thought to, but sounds like is something that's very important to become more mindful of. We've talked about getting more sleep. We've talked about the importance of managing stress, at least not letting stress levels get above a certain level where they're creating health issues. Now, fitness is a whole other part of this that we haven't even touched on yet, but can you talk about how that plugs into the other suite of elements I just mentioned?
Yeah, you know, humans, I really like that you guys talk about resiliency, and I love the resiliency concept, and I guess kind of an extension of that is a guy that I follow a lot, Nassim Taleb, and he talks about anti-fragility, you know, that the living dynamic systems go beyond even resiliency, but go into an anti-fragile state. And what his description of that just really resonates with me is that if we are exposed to a stress, but a stress that's not overwhelming, something that we can adapt to, we become stronger in response to that. And humans are definitely, you know, wired into our genetics as this expectation for us to be active, to move our bodies, to be challenged on occasion. But it's interesting. Our society, particularly westernized cultures, seem to fall into two disparate camps. The one camp, we have folks that we literally need to douse them with gasoline to get them off of the couch. The other group are a bunch of folks that want to emulate the elite athletes, you know, the Tour de France competitors and whatnot. And so we have some people who are doing far too little activity. We have another group of folks that are doing far too much activity. And for our kind of ancestral norm, we should be walking, we should be lifting some weights, we should stretch, we should do, as much novel activity outdoors with the sun shining on our skin as we can. And it's not to say that, you know, if you want to become a competitive athlete, don't do that. But I think that many, many people assume that the level of activity necessary to become a really legitimately competitive athlete, that they assume that that is going to be beneficial for them from a health and longevity standpoint, and our data on that clearly indicates that that's not the case. Like it's better to maybe be a middle of the road athlete and focus a little bit on health and longevity if you really wanted to get the maximum return on investment from exercise. But exercise is just it's what's called a hormetic stressor. Hormesis is this process where we're exposed to a stress. The body is given some time to adapt, and then when it adapts, it comes back stronger from that initial stress.
All right. Well, let's get practical here then. Let's first talk fitness and activity, and then let's talk diet. Let's say someone's listening to this podcast. They're middle-aged. They're a professional, meaning they've got likely a desk job that they have to go to during the day. What type of activity should this person be looking to to integrate into their life to be, you know, in your definition, not exercising too little, but not exercising too much either?
You know, I think that a nice variety of activity, doing some walking, doing some circuit training, either with body weight activities or a mix of body weight and weight related activities, doing some stretching and yoga. If you like swimming, doing some swimming. I really like is broad an activity base as we can get folks doing. And this is great from an orthopedic standpoint. It's great because when we do new activities, it stimulates the brain. When we're learning new activities, it stimulates the release of a substance called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And so we actually grow new new neurons and new connections in the brain, and so it's very helpful in that regard. I guess the main takeaway is for folks to find something that they really like and they are going to stick to over the long haul. Like, that's really the most important piece to this. In my own idealistic situation, I would love to see people lift weights either in like a classic, you know, weightlifting format or in a circuit weight training format a couple of days a week. I'd love to see people out walking, you know, daily and covering as much ground as is reasonable for them to cover in their, you know, their busy lives. And then from there, just some more mellow, open-ended activities, doing some yoga, doing some martial arts, something like that, to just keep them stimulated and engaged and make the fitness process fun.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It jives a bit with what Mark Sisson was talking with Chris about when Chris interviewed him about a year ago or so, sort of the importance of play in the activity. So making sure that you get some enjoyment, that you're going to want to do it, again. You've also mentioned some elements that sound somewhat familiar to me to the whole CrossFit mentality, which is, you know, trying to keep things mixed up so that your body's not just getting routinized by doing the same activity again and again and again. Would you say that both those two elements are sort of a part of what you recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark is actually a great friend of mine. We get to hang out a lot. I just got to speak at one of his conferences recently, and I was actually one of the early, kind of founders in the CrossFit scene. I helped to start the first and fourth CrossFit gyms in the world early on. And I actually had a bit of a parting with those folks. I really liked the concept. And early in the development of CrossFit, they had a very economics-based view of fitness, and that they were trying to figure out what's the minimum investment I need to do to get the maximum return on my fitness. And, these brief body weight and weight implement circuits, sprint intervals and stuff like that. And I think that we understand the exercise physiology sufficiently to say that really provides a remarkable return on investment. Like, it really beats long, low, steady cardio, you know, pounding away on a treadmill or whatnot. Where CrossFit has kind of gone a little bit problematic for me is that it's become a sport, and so they call it the sport of fitness now. And so now, instead of trying to figure out what's the minimum that you can do to get the maximum return, now folks are trying to figure out what's the maximum that I can do and not kill myself in this process. And it's really a very cool sport, you know, if that's what you want to do. So I'm not, running it down in that regard. But from this kind of performance, health, longevity standpoint, if people were to look at the early iterations of CrossFit where you were trying to, or just think about what's the minimum effective dose that I can do to get what I need, you know, the base level of cardio and strength and mobility, and then that's enough, you know. So it's trying to figure out what's the absolute minimum you could do to affect the body composition goals, to be able to allow you to do the work that you want to do. And I think that that's kind of the orientation to take on that.
All right. Well, let's help people understand that just a little bit better. So it sounds like you would say, look, rather than going out for a 5-mile run, go out maybe for 10 minutes of hill repeats or wind sprints or something like that. Or if you're lifting weights, maybe, you know, a short intense burst workout would be better than, you know, an hour long workout. How do you help people kind of conceptualize how to, what's enough time to get what they want to get out of it?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, a nice way that you can break that stuff up, let's take that example of like some hill sprints or something. So versus the long 5-mile run that may take 45 minutes, we could do, clearly you warm up, and this is assuming people are orthopedically and, you know, sound and ready to go with this, but they might do a brisk sprint up a hill. At the top of the hill, maybe they've rigged up a pull-up bar, or maybe they just do some push-ups or some air squats or some sit-ups or something. They walk back down the hill at a pretty brisk pace, and they see how many rounds of that activity they can get done in 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And then the next day they do something quite different, or maybe the next day is their easy recovery day where they just go on a walk. If somebody just has access to, say, like a 24-hour fitness or something like that, they might just cruise through the weight machines, or the, you know, if they're familiar with free weights, they might figure out a loading of weights where they could do, say, like 8 to 10 reps pretty comfortably with, say, like a bench press or a lat pull down or something, and maybe some leg press. And they just create a circuit of that, and they try to get, say, as many rounds of that as they can, anywhere from like 5 to 10 reps, and try to get, a leg press, a lat pull down, a bench press, and they try to get as many rounds of 5 to 10 reps as they can get, again, in like 5 to 10 minutes or 10 to 15 minutes, something along that line. And you could really try to push hard and kind of redline on those workouts occasionally, or you can take about a 70 to 80% effort where you just have a steady breathing pace, your heart rate is elevated, you're breathing, certainly above what you would be doing if you're just sitting down or even walking at a brisk pace. So I mean it's challenging, but you can really meter the dose in that way, and 10 to 15 minutes of that is remarkably effective on both a calorie burning standpoint, but also the hormonal response we get from that. We release some growth hormone and some testosterone. That's good for both men and women. It's challenging. It's pretty fun, and it's short enough that you don't really lose focus, and you're kind of like, oh man, this is really becoming boring. And then, to the degree that you can round that out with some nice long walks or maybe a easy swim or a bike ride to kind of cool down, then I think that's a great way to break this stuff up.
Great, great. Well, I think that's really helpful directive guidance for folks, and hopefully is good news in the sense that folks realize that even if they have busy lives and don't have a lot of time, for hours of exercise, that they can actually pack most of what they need into a much shorter time frame.
Absolutely.
Well, let me, since we're approaching the end of our time here, and Rob, I'd love to have you back on again, because I have a whole bunch of questions here that we're just not going to have time to get to this time, but would certainly love to bring you back on in the future if there's interest on your end. I do want to close with a topic that I believe is of interest to you, which is the integrity of our food distribution systems. Can you tell us about your interest there and what changes you're working to affect in that area?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's possibly a whole show in and of itself. I'll try to be concise on that.
Let's consider this a preview, and then we can really delve into it in a future show.
Absolutely. Just early in this whole story, I was a research biochemist years ago. I actually got exposed to this paleo diet concept in 1998, kind of an extension of some serious health problems that I had. And I started researching this stuff, went and did a fellowship with Lauren Cordain and started working with people, implementing this paleo diet concept. But early in this story, I realized that the sustainability of our food and the access of just our ability to access quality food, grass-fed meat, sustainably harvested fish, fruits, vegetables, whatever it is that you're eating, that a lot of this stuff was in danger of kind of going away, and that we were going to become very, very dependent on a very fragile monocrop system, a very fragile, just on-time delivery kind of scenario with our food supply. And so I started working initially just out of our own gym in Chico, California, encouraging some of the local farmers and people who produce food in that area to produce grass-fed meat and to start shifting more towards organics. And it's been fascinating, the explosion process. In Chico, California, we kind of created this template for encouraging people to produce grass-fed meat, shifting from conventional to pastured meat, really developing a network of CSAs interacting with our gym. And because I've had access to just thousands of gyms around the world, I've been kind of promulgating that message that people need to look towards a decentralized, more stable food supply story. And again, to keep this concise, we started doing some work with Alan Savory of the Savory Institute, who's been instrumental in developing a reversal of desertification process using permaculture, using grass eating ungulates and a rotation of these animals with other animals to reverse desert areas in Africa. We've been working with Joel Salatin of Pollock Based Farms, who uses a very similar permaculture technique and water management technique to invigorate his Pollock Based Farms and make it both very, very economically successful, but also one of the most calorically and nutritionally successful farming stories on the planet. And so that's been kind of the background story that I've really focused a ton of my effort. Everybody wants to look good, and they want their cardiovascular health to be improved, and they want to live a long, healthy life and whatnot, and all that is fantastic, but all of that is moot if we don't have a stable food supply. And I think, as you guys have talked about it so much on your shows and your writing, the way that our energy story is playing out, the way that our environmental story is playing out, we really need to think about some kind of fallback measures or some alternate ways of approaching our food distribution system so that we have some resiliency in store. We have some alternatives if we have some hiccups in the general food supply.
Well, that's exactly true. And I'm just so thrilled to hear that we've got minds and leaders like yourself out there continuing to help blaze that trail. And as we mentioned, I'd love to have you back on again and really dive in more deeply into the actual solutions that you're trying to put in place there. But for now, I'll just say thank you for your focus on that really important issue. And with that, I will, I'll end with one last question, which is for people that are listening and interested in learning more about you and what you're up to and the programs that you're running, where can they go to learn more?
Oh, gosh, robwolf.com. We have everything that anybody would need to do a paleo template for free. You just go to the website, and there's a big, giant red button that says start here, and it will walk you through shopping and food guides, a 30-day meal plan, everything that you would ever need to know and to understand paleo and to be able to do it. That's on there. There's some workout information on the site as well. I have a podcast also called the Paleo Solution Podcast, and we have 3 years of archived material on that. And so if people have specific health concerns, a pretty good chance that I've covered it in that show. And so you can just use the search engine on the site. And if you have polycystic kidney disease or type 2 diabetes or whatever, we've probably talked about it and have provided some theoretical strategies for how to tackle that.
Excellent. And I know that iTunes podcast that you mentioned, it's one of the more popular podcasts on iTunes, and it really is an excellent production. So
Thanks.
That are interested in learning more, definitely go check out Rob's site, but listen to the podcast as well. And with that, Rob, I'll thank you so much for joining us today.
Huge honor being on the show. And again, I just cannot thank you guys enough for the work that you're doing. I knew that the type of things, before I found you guys, I knew that these topics that you're talking about, energy, the environment, and the economy, were so, so important. But I had not found anybody that had provided the treatment and the integration that you guys have done. You're really doing amazing work.
Well, thank you. And if that integration can involve integrating more of your content and knowledge into the experience, we certainly want to do that.
I would love to help any way I can. It's just very exciting.
Great, Rob. Well, hey, thank you so much, and I look forward to having you on again.
Thanks, Adam. Take care.
Bye.